Okay.
This is our last day on chapter 8. And it's almost the last day of our semester. Things are coming to a close quickly.
So, next Thursday, I will
give you some highlights of chapter 10. I think the syllabus originally had some more time for this stuff, some time for chapter 9, and 2 days for chapter 10. But things are compressed over. Some earlier topics took longer than I thought, and there was the makeup exam. The ideas in there will be trace and determinant. Which are, from Axler's point of view, right, the sum of the eigenvalues and the product of the eigenvalues, according to the right multiplicity. We'll get to that. Serves. I mentioned Cayley's theorem, so I guess we'll see from last time. Last time was a while ago, before Thanksgiving week. Cayley's theorem says that the polynomial of a certain operator will kill off every vector. And some authors will write it with the Greek letter key for characteristic, ch. This is often called the characteristic polynomial. That's what it's called in our book, too. Remember what this is. Z minus lambda 1 raised to the power, let's call it M1 product with a bunch of other factors like that, all the way out to lambda K or P, whatever you want to call it. Let's say we go out to lambda K. P is a bad choice because of value. Well, I'll use P for later. Okay.
Now this talked about last time, the power you need on each z minus lambda is the dimension of that generalized eigenspace. And as usual, T is a linear operator going from V to V, and V is a finite-dimensional vector space. And what else do you need? You want the field to be the complex numbers, right? So you actually have
eigenvalues.
Remember, if you only allow real scalars, you may not have any eigenvalues at all, because maybe you're rotating the plane 30 degrees or something. Okay. Now, let me put an example out here.
Let's make this very concrete. Okay?
So let's say we're in 11-dimensional space. Okay. And then we have this is the standard basis. And let's say that for this basis, the matrix is already in Jordan normal form. Okay. I talked about Jordan normal form. I kept getting ahead of the textbook, kept talking about Jordan normal form, even though it's only in section 8D that's officially defined. So the next best thing to being diagonal. I'm just going to write the non-zero entries. What's the funny example I picked here? Yes, okay. So everything not shown is just a zero. So you have a bunch of fours on the diagonal, and some fives, and some sixes, and some sevens. So that's bad. And then it's upper triangular, yeah? It's all zeros below the diagonal, but there's a little bit of stuff above the diagonal. The only stuff you get above the diagonal are some ones. Sometimes. You either get ones or zeros. And they only get to be on the so-called super diagonal. And when you have a one, if you look at what's next to it, it's always the same number, right? You don't have a 1 linking a 4 and a 5, for example.
That's part of the requirement of the Jordan normal form.
Okay, so if I show you this matrix, can you tell me what's the characteristic polynomial of T? Well, it's going to be 0, sure. Now, that's when you actually plug in T. But what if I plug in an arbitrary complex number Z? Then what do I get for the characteristic polynomial as a formula, right?
Triangular matrix, right?
Okay. So, what are the eigenvalues? When it's upper triangular, there's an easy way to say what the eigenvalues are. So, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay? So, z minus 4 to some power. Z minus 5 to some power, Z minus 6 to some power, and finally Z minus 7 to some power. And what are those powers? Yeah, 5, 3, 2, 1. It's what it looks like. Yeah. I'm not doing anything tricky here. See, what's going on here is you have your generalized eigenspace for 4. So, for example, you're interested in why is there a 5 there? So you're looking at the null space of T minus 4 times the identity raised to the power 11. Which we like to abbreviate as just G of 4, T. Because G of 4, T has basis, so I claim E1 through E5. And that was our... let me see if we can see that, right? To make a little table here. So you have some, say you want to look at those first 5, you want to ask, what does, say, T-4i due to it. And then ask what happens if we apply that again. And in principle, you might have to keep going a long way, but with this particular thing, all the so-called Jordan chains are of length at most 2. So if you just look up there, T sends E1 to 4 times E1. 4i sends E1 to 4 times E1. That's just 0. Okay. So you're going to get 0 and more zeros thereafter, right? If you do higher powers and so on. If you just keep going, you'll just get more and more zeros. Zeros on E2. This one's a little more interesting. So E1's an actual straight-up eigenvector, right? It just gets multiplied by 4 by when you apply T. What about E2? What does T give you when you apply E2?
Is that also a straight-up eigenvector?
We have to remember what the matrix represents, okay? So different pieces of the matrix represent different outputs, right? What piece of the matrix represents T E2? Is it the second row or the second column? No, it's the column. The first column represents T of E1. And since there's a 4 at the top, it just came out 4 of E1. The second column is T of E2. And what do you see in the second column? Just a 4 in the second entry. So this is another straight-up eigenvector. It's not one of those generalized ones. It's an actual eigenvector. So this is 0. And you apply anything, any linear operator to a 0, you just get more zeros. Okay. E3 is more interesting, yes? If we apply T to E3, what we get is in the third column, or it's encoded by the third column. So what does the third column then tell us?
1E2, right?
Plus 4E3. And then we have to subtract off 4 times the identity applied to E3. So you just get E2. So now if we apply T minus 4i again, we're going to get what it did to E2, which is a big 0, and then it'll be zeros thereafter as well, right? So E3 is not an eigenvector, but it is a generalized eigenvector. The matrix doesn't multiply it by 4, but if you apply the matrix, or really I should say the transformation, and then always subtract off 4 times the identity, then the first time doesn't zero it out because you're not multiplying it by 4 when you apply T, but the second time does zero it out. So it's a generalized eigenvector. And now you can see that with E4 and E5, it's going to be the same thing, right? Just different indices. So. Lots of zeros. Okay. So this shows that those five things are all in this null space. Because if you apply this t minus 4i 11 times, yeah, you've zeroed them all out. In fact, just applying it twice zeros all of them out. Okay. So that would show that the dimension is at least 5. Maybe that's why does that follow? Why can I say the dimension is at least 5? Just from knowing that E1 through E5 are in there. I'm trying to convince a skeptical reader here, right? I just proved that E1 through E5 are in this space, and then I say, so the dimension of the space is at least 5 because what? I mean, if I tell you that 5 vectors are in a space, that doesn't mean the dimension is 5, right? There's something special about these 5 vectors that lets me know that if they're in the space, the dimension is at least 5.
What are the bases?
Yeah, they're part of a basis, so they're independent. Right? If you go all the way out to E11, they're a basis, so they're independent. That's the key. So they're linearly independent, and if somebody was really skeptical, why are they linearly independent? Well, then you could say, because they're part of a basis, right? Basis is, by definition, linearly independent and spanning whatever the space you're talking about, in this case, C11. Okay, so the dimension's at least 5. Now, if you wanted to prove that the dimension is exactly 5, you have a couple options, right? One option would be to actually compute, say, the 11th power of t minus 4i, or actually just the second power of t minus 4i would be enough in this case, since everything gets zeroed out by the time you square it. So you actually could just subtract 4 off the diagonal, compute the square, and then actually just look at the matrix and verify that nothing else is in the null space. Except the stuff spanned by E1 through E5. You'd have to show that coordinates 6 through 11 are always 0 if you're in the null space. So that would be one approach. Right? Find this matrix here. Then we'd be proving something like a t minus 4i squared applied to, say, some vector x1 through x11, a list of 11 numbers. If this equals 0, then everything after the fifth coordinate has to be 0. That's the direct approach. Doesn't rely on any high theory beyond just basic definitions of, you know, what is this space, right? It's a null space of, you know, enough powers of this thing. And you can show that you don't even need 11 of them. Just, well, okay. Okay. Should be careful here. Okay. You need one more thing. You need to know that if you apply you need to prove that applying more powers all the way up to 11 won't give you more. So you would need to check that after you do the third power, that doesn't give you anything new. Okay. So that if the third, you need to check that the third power. You actually do need to get the third power. Okay. A little bit harder. So you need to justify this.
Kind of a pain.
The sophisticated way would be to cite some theorem that's done all the hard work for you.
Okay.
I feel like the grammar on that's not 100%, so let me make an epsilon improvement to the grammar here. So x6, x7, dot, 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 equals x11 equals 0. By computing this, put a period there and then say this thing here then must be proved would probably be a grammatical way of phrasing it, right? You have to prove this, right? That something like this. Show that applying T-4i 3 times won't zero out anything that wasn't already zeroed out, so you know that you don't need to go any further, like say all the way up to the 11th power. And then say, okay, so let's just look at then 2, because we know 2 is enough now, and check that, the only way to kill off stuff with that is just to make coordinates 6 through 11 0. If you don't make all those coordinates 0, you're sunk. Okay? This would show that really the null space that we're interested in, G4T, really is spanned by E1 through E5. So this dimension really is at most 5. So the sophisticated alternative is don't try to prove any of these kinds of things directly. Just continue this easier kind of computation here, right, for the other eigenvalues. Right? So we proved here that
E1 through E5 were generalized eigenvectors for eigenvalues 4. Again, for 5, 6, and 7. So prove that these three, which are linearly independent, E6, E7, E8, are in G of 5, comma T. And then E9 and E10 would be in G6, comma T. And finally, E11 is in G7, comma T. So this shows that the dimensions have lower bounds as follows. Let's call this thing just the dimensions, right? So we had 4, 5, 6, and 7, and the dimensions must be greater than 5, greater than or equal to 5, greater than or equal to 3, greater than or equal to 2, and greater than or equal to 1. You now use the fact that there's a theorem that did some hard work for us, right? That when you have distinct eigenvalues, the generalized eigenspaces are independent from each other. More precisely, they're a direct sum. In this case, they're a direct sum, that has been shown to be equivalent to their dimensions adding up. Okay, so these dimensions have to add up to their span. Right? Well, okay. So these dimensions will add up and so now you can take the sum of the vector spaces. This is actually equivalent to being a direct sum in the finite dimensional case, at least, that your dimensions add up. When you're not a direct sum, when there's some kind of overlap or some kind of weird three or four way or more way dependence, then the dimensions add up too big. This number will be too big compared to the dimension of the sum, which would take into account the overlaps and dependencies. But if they're independent of each other, right, more precise, if they're a direct sum, then it adds up. But this dimension here Well, this is a subspace of V. So its dimension is at most 11. Our V is just C to the 11. Okay, so on the one hand, you've got some numbers, at least 5, at least 3, at least 2, and at least 1, respectively. On the other hand, they add up to at most 11. So 5 plus 3 plus 2 plus 1 is already 11. So there's no room to make any of the numbers any higher. Okay. So I guess you can just put it right here. So there's no room. If you increase this to 6, you're going to make this sum at least 12. And that's too big. And likewise, you can't increase the dimension of any of the others. There's just not room for it. Kind of cheating in the sense that you let somebody else do the hard work of proving that theorem. But on the other hand, that's kind of the point of theorems, is to make it easier for us to understand stuff. Right? So this is making it easier for us to be sure we understand the structure of this operator. We can say, yeah, we're sure that the generalized eigenspace for eigenvalue 4 really is five-dimensional. And even if we don't remember the details of this proof, we've gotten some understanding here. And if we want to, we can look up the proof and recover a deeper understanding of why it has to work out this way. So that's how you could avoid a direct computation. I didn't have to actually square or cube any matrix here. Questions or comments about this? So this is the characteristic polynomial, right? Z to the 4 raised to the power 5, because that's the dimension of that generalized eigenspace, and then the z minus 5 raised to the appropriate power, the z minus 6 raised to the right power, the z minus 7 raised to the right power. All based on these dimensions that you can just see. Now, there's another polynomial covered in 8c. The minimal polynomial. So that's where I want to go next.
I just need to photograph before I erase. Thank you.
Okay. So the characteristic polynomial is just given by definition as you take z minus each eigenvalue, you raise it to the power given by the dimension of the generalized eigenspace, and you multiply all those terms. So that's just what it is by definition. Cayley's theorem says you plug in t for z, and it's the zero operator. It annihilates every vector. Now, the minimal polynomial is the efficient version of the characteristic polynomial. Okay? In our example here, it is true that if you apply, I guess you want to read this from right to left, so let me write it out and then we'll read it backwards. Okay? So this is zero by Cayley's theorem, and it's not too hard to believe, right? First you apply t minus 7i, and that kills off your 11th component, right? Then you apply t minus 6i, and that will kill off your 9th and 10th components. And then you apply t minus 5i three times, and I claim that'll kill off your 6th, 7th, and 8th components. And you apply t minus 4i twice, and as we saw, that will kill off components 1 through 5, right? E1, E2, E3, E5, those all get annihilated. So then you have to do a little bit of checking, but if you feed something through those four stages, everything does indeed get killed off. Part of the reason you can be sure of that is because those generalized eigenspaces are each invariant, right? When you have something that's, say, just in the span of these two, right? You apply t, you get something still in the span of those two. But in any case, all you have to do really by linearity is say, hey, each of the basis vectors, E1 through E11, will get killed. So, for example, if you wanted to see why, let's say we wanted to see why E7 gets killed. And, well, here's what's going to happen. These things, since they're all just made up of T and I, the identity operator, and T and I commute with each other, all of these factors commute with each other. So you can reorder this as follows. And this is zero, because, you apply t minus 5i to E7, and let's see here. So down here, column 7, right, what do you get? Well, you get an E6 when you apply t, and you also get 5 E7s, but then you subtract 5i, so you subtract 5 E7s, so this just gives you E6. So you apply this once, you go to E6, but then you apply t minus 5i to E6, and then, oh, hey, look at that. T will just multiply it by 5, but then you're subtracting 5 of E6s, so you get 0. So just applying t minus 5i twice will kill this one off. If you go to E8, you really do have to apply it three times, though. Okay? So here's the efficient version. Remember with eigenvalue 4, we only had to apply it twice to kill everything off. So we don't need a 5 there. We could just have a 2. Now, with eigenvalue 5, you really do need a 3, because if you look at E8, first, I'll just go ahead and write it here. T minus 5i applied to E8 just gives you E7, right? And then, well, we saw what happens next, right? T minus 5i E7 gives you E6. And then finally, after the third application, you've annihilated E8, right? So you really do need 3 to actually make P of T be 0 here. But you don't need a 5 here. You just need a 2. Because T minus 4i applied twice kills off E1 through E5. Right? How many factors of T minus 6i do I need? 1. Yeah. And same with T minus 7i. So that's all the minimal polynomial is. Just reduce those powers as low as you can. And you can prove some theorems, like the book does, that if you want this to be a polynomial with a leading coefficient of 1, say, and you want it to zero out t when you plug it in to make the polynomial applied to t be the zero operator, then this is the unique lowest degree polynomial with leading coefficient 1, right? Its degree is 2 plus 3 plus 1 plus 1, so it's degree 7, right? If you try and find a degree 6 polynomial that will turn t into 0, you won't find it. If you try and find a degree 7 polynomial that will make t be 0, and you stipulate that the leading coefficient, so the t to the 7th coefficient after you expand this out, if you demand that be 1, then it will turn out that the only 7th degree polynomial you'll find that'll work will be this one. All the others that would work at degree 7 would just be constant multiples of this polynomial. So in that strong sense, it's minimal. And I can just look at that matrix once it's in Jordan form, and I can just read off these numbers, because I just look at the length of the Jordan chains, right? Like we had E8, right? We applied T minus 5i once, got to E7, again, got to E6, on the third time, annihilated. That's a Jordan chain of length 3. There was no like E9 to come before it, right? This is a Jordan chain of length 3, and you can just see it, 8 to 7 to 6 to nothing, right? Because that's the end of the 5s. So that's a chain of length 3 with the two 1s here. This is a chain of length 2, another Jordan chain of length 2. All the other Jordan chains are just trivial, length 1. They're actual eigenvectors on their own. So I can just read it off, how many factors.
What would have happened if one of the ones was moved on E3, the one on E3 was moved to, let's say, E2.
I think this is the kind of question where you should come up and draw the matrix for me if you want me to answer it. I mean, I'm happy to. We should, realistically, we should put it. I guess. Okay. So here's my matrix. If you want, you can make up another matrix here, and we can, write down the minimal polynomial. I'm not confident I'll understand what you're after if you just tell me I want a 1 there, or whatever here.
4, 4, 4.
Yeah.
Yeah.
and this one was there.
Okay. So that's the same.
That would be the same?
Yeah. Because you have the same kind of Jordan chain. Right? You have a chain of length 2 here, mm-hmm. length 1 here, and length 2 here. If we apply T minus 4i to... I guess we just make a list, right?
That's only when they're together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a Jordan chain. This one, this one, this one. Yeah. You make a table, you know. I think just looking at the first 3 will be sufficient to see what's going on here, right? So when you apply T minus 4i, E2 goes to E1, and then E1 is annihilated. Right? And E3 is annihilated right away. And if you do, I guess, E4 and E5, you know, it's just going to look like E1 and E2 again. Here we just have little chains, right? Okay. That is the story with that. The main, you know, nice result, of course, is that in the complex vector space of finite dimension of any linear operator, there always is a basis that puts it in Jordan form. You find all the eigenvalues, and then you just keep looking for Jordan chains, right? And whether you do it brute force or in some very clever way, eventually you find enough Jordan chains such that you've got enough vectors that they're going to span the whole space, and then you're done. The trick is that, you know, in general, you know, it doesn't have to be such a nice matrix, right? It could be this horrible matrix, and, you know, how do you find an eigenvector at all, blah, blah, blah. But, yeah. This is the ideal. You can find a basis, at least approximately, right? Just like you can find the eigenvalues at least approximately. With your computer.
Okay.
So, that's the characteristic polynomial and the minimal polynomial. And I haven't formally written down, like, the definition of Jordan normal form, right? Or just Jordan form. But I've said it and illustrated it informally, and you can read the precise description of it in the textbook. But it's just this idea of, okay, you group the eigenvalues on the diagonal, and the only other non-zero entries will be some ones above eigenvalues, and they can. And when you have those ones, you think of it informally as linking some stuff into a chain. They only form a link when they're with the same eigenvalue. So you can't have a 1 here linking the 4 and the 5. So, very nice. Diagonal, except maybe some 1s on the super diagonal. Everything else, 0. And for emphasis, it's the same input basis as the output basis, right?
with the singular value decomposition,
chapter 7,
you had to pay the price of different input and output bases, but the benefit was you got perfectly diagonal matrix, and the bases were each orthonormal, right? So you had to put more in terms of having an inner product structure, but then you got some more out, but you had to pay a price to get perfectly diagonal different input and output bases. This is the best you can do if you want the input and output basis to be the same. Okay. So, questions or comments about this? I'll tell you a little bit about the final exam. What I'm going to do is I will pick some questions and announce them in advance. But I will keep some of the questions a surprise. So you have to study for everything. Study everything if you want an A. But maybe you can arrange to have maybe a C or something on the final if you can get half of them done in advance. Okay. And you can figure them all out correctly. So stay tuned for that announcement. I'm thinking something like 4 questions, say, and you do all 4. I announce 2 of them in advance, and the other 2 are a surprise. And hopefully, we won't need all 3 hours on December 7th for that. That's the same thing I'm doing for my advanced calculus classes final exam. 2 surprises, 2 announced in advance. Right. So that's my plan for the final exam. Any questions you all have?
The surprise is going to be focused more on what we took at the beginning, or...
It's comprehensive. So, maybe one of the ones I announce in advance will be more recent, and maybe the other one will be earlier, and then maybe the surprises will be one early, one advanced,
Yeah.
It's been a bit of an experiment. I haven't done this thing before where I promised, to draw from the homework and solved in-class problems on the final exam. So I'm figuring out exactly how difficult it is. The midterm gave me a good idea. And I think I need to have a little bit of a compromise with some advanced warning on it. I think that'll... give me a reasonable level of difficulty. Okay. Other questions?
Is it going to be like a couple to choose from, or just 2 stated? The surprises are just going to be just 2, or pick 2 of 6 possible ones?
I'm just going to pick 2.
Okay.
Since you'll know some of them, I'll just say, do these 4. End of story.
Nothing having to do with the final exam. Do you have any more homeworks to return?
Unfortunately, I didn't get to that today. I was going to, but my apologies. Several things came up. Several unexpected meetings and a car battery. I did grade all of the revised exams, although you didn't take them retakes. So
is there any way you can email us, like, the homeworks we are missing?
That you're missing? Have you ever seen one of those grade update emails from me?
Yeah. can't report credit.
But the last ones that I turned in, I can't remember.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, yeah. I mean, I don't have a ton here. So, actually, let's see. I have this one here. Sometimes I return stuff like the Thursday before Thanksgiving or something, except I couldn't because the person wasn't there. Well, anyways. Wait. But, let's see. Okay, so, yeah, I'm sorry I didn't have these graded like I thought I would. But,
I can check out the
class. I see, I have what you have, yeah. I can show you what I have from you after class. Sure. So.
Any other questions? All right. Well, I will, I guess, not going to do any more homework because you'd only have 2 days to do it. So you all probably want to finish any outstanding homework you can and turn it in on Thursday. So I'll just, sorry, is there a question? Just say a little preview then for chapter 10, which I'm worried I'll be pressed for time when I explain it on Thursday. That's what I'm trying to just touch on. Right? Okay. Chapter 10. Okay. So, the idea here is you want to define the trace and the determinant of a linear operator on your finite-dimensional space V without picking a basis. If you pick a basis, then you can write down the matrix, and then the trace is super easy. Add up everything on the diagonal. And the determinant, well, that can be a pain, but there's a formula for it. Many formulas for it, actually. Okay. So, but the point is, you're doing this without having any matrix. You want to have a purely abstract definition that doesn't depend on matrices or so the trace of T is going to be the eigenvalues added with respect to multiplicity. Right? So in our example, in general, it's the just adding all the eigenvalues added, but you have multiplicity, right, for the jth eigenvalue, you're going to take the dimension of the generalized eigenspace, right? And that's how many times you'll have that eigenvalue, right? So there's, you know, 5 4s in there because that's the dimension of that generalized eigenspace. And then the determinant is very similar. Instead of adding, we multiply.
So that's the idea. And you may remember some stuff, like if you remember a formula for determinant of a matrix involving, say, permutations, then if you think about how permutations act on, say, an upper triangular matrix, whenever you swap two things, like think of swapping from like this 4 and this 4 over to here and here, that kind of permutation, what's going to happen is one of your entries will be below the diagonal where it'll be a 0. And any upper triangular matrix has determinant equal to the product of the diagonal entries. So if you put your matrix, say, in Jordan form, then that matrix definition will match this definition, right? But the crazy thing is that no matter which basis you pick, whether it's the nice Jordan normal form basis or some other basis that makes your matrix look random and ugly, the determinant of the matrix will always come out the same. It only depends on the operator, not on the matrix, right? The matrix depends on the operator and your basis. The determinant really only depends on the operator. And likewise, this trace, which in terms of a matrix is just you add up the diagonal entries, it really only depends on the operator. If you pick another basis for this thing, and then you get some ugly matrix, if you look at the diagonal entries, they will still add up to this number, which is what? 35, 47, 54, right? This will still add up, this diagonal add up to 54, no matter what basis you pick. So, that's where we will go on Thursday. I may have to say some things about Chapter 9 to the extent I get that deep into the theory. We shall see. Still need to plan out that lesson. And I will certainly grade all the homeworks I already have here and return them on Thursday. You turn in some more homeworks now, I will do my best to return those on Thursday as well. Sorry I got a little bit behind on the grading while I was away for a week. Get caught back up. And then anything you turn in on Thursday, I should be able to grade it and at least get it back to you when you turn in your final exam. Yes.